welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. It is now or never that debt is fraud. Please make sure you continue to read along with us because that's how you can learn. And if you learn, you can be more effective in your appeal to heaven because learn, pray, and act. That's how we can get this stuff done, folks. Now, all things being said, we are focused on how to hold our public servants accountable. There's some ambiguity by many organizations. Oh, it's all about Section or Article 6 and the oath of office. Well, Article 6 alone is it's the required oath that actually establishes the base. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is what where the teeth is. In other words, as long as they take an oath and we can't hold them accountable, we can't use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment because they refuse to be held accountable, then we've got a problem. And that's why we actually have to use First Amendment petitions. So getting involved and getting engaged is critical. And this is why we need people to start running campaigns, petition campaigns, running your own personal campaign. It begins today. Now, we left off with the notes, Madison's notes on the convention. We've moved quite a bit along. We're towards the end of August, August 22nd still. But we kind of left off with, I believe, Mr. Williamson. So we're on Mr. King of Massachusetts. Is that correct, Tammy? And welcome back, by the way.
Yeah. I'm just reading here. I thought we were on Mr. Williamson, but it could be incorrect.
Well, I think yesterday you pointed out the $10
right.
And 50.
Part of it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, did you not finish the whole thing?
I didn't.
Oh, okay. So go ahead and finish it then. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll start. It imposed a duty of $5 on each slave imported from Africa, 10 on each from elsewhere, and 50 on each from a state licensing manumission. He thought the southern states could not be members of the Union if the clause should be rejected, and that it was wrong to force anything down not absolutely necessary and which any state must disagree to.
So even though Mr. Williamson sounded like, you know, he was in, well, he's from North Carolina. It's just wrong to take away what we want to do. The right of self-determination. Okay. Mr. King
thought the subject should be considered in a political light only. If two states will not agree to the Constitution as stated on one side, he could affirm with equal belief on the other that a great and equal opposition would be experienced from the other states. He remarked on the exemption of slaves from duty, whilst every other import was subjected to it, as an inequality that could not fail to strike the commercial sagacity of the northern and middle states.
Okay, so sagacity, what is that?
Sagacity. I have no idea.
Wisdom, sagaclonus, knowledge, erudition, understanding, intelligence, perceptiveness. There you go. That's a good word right there. Sagacity. Sagacity, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Mr. Langdon, these are kind of little short quips. So Mr. Langdon
was strenuous for giving the power to the general government. He could not, with a good conscience, leave it with the states, who could then go with the traffic without being restrained by the opinions here given that they will themselves cease to import slaves.
Okay, so now General Pinckney of South Carolina and then Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina, and they just go on and on and on. And folks, I'm just going to go ahead and leave this here. It goes a while where they keep on bringing this up. And so on the question of, now what are they trying to do here? On question for committing Section 6 as to the Navigation Act to a member from each state, Yes, yes, no, no. Yes, 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 yes. So it carried. Okay, so then it went on and on and on. All of this is highlighted because this is really where they started going through the Constitution, like ex post facto laws and so forth and so on. And so they were kind of getting the Constitution to take more form. Now, if I could get everybody to go down to Thursday, August 23rd, the next day, they start talking about the militia and more details about the militia. So let's go ahead and start with, who is that? Who's speaking here? In convention, that doesn't even say. Oh, this is a report on the committee, so I don't know who actually says this. Go ahead.
Okay. The report of the Committee of 11 made August 21st being taken up and the following clause being under consideration, to wit, to make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the U.S., reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed.
Okay, so in other words, these are the lines that they're starting to put in Article 1, Section 8. And so Mr. Sherman moved to strike out the last member, quote, and authority of training, etc. He thought it unnecessary. The states will have this authority, of course, if not given up. Remember, at this point in time, and I need to highlight this, so I'm highlighting this red. At this point in time, this is the first time, if not given up, they started all kind of solidifying. They all were coming together on this concept that the Constitution would only delegate specific powers. Everything was left to the states if it wasn't delegated. That's why that is significant there. Because he says, well, why do we have to say that the states can do that? We're not giving that up. So, Mr. Ellsworth, go ahead.
Mr. Ellsworth doubted the propriety of striking out this sentence. The reason assigned applies as well to other reservation of the appointment to offices. He remarked at the same time that the term discipline was of vast extent and might be so expounded as to include all power on the subject.
And I agree, because when we look at the federal government having the power to call for, to organize, right? I mean, let's look at the lineup just above this, that they would have to the power to make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part. So they needed to make sure that they clearly delineated that they could not have this power to do the training. That had to be reserved to the states, the selection of officers, the states. So they needed to identify that there was this mutual or shared responsibility regarding the militia and so forth and so on, which has been completely abandoned. But let's go ahead, Mr. Ellsworth. Oh, actually, you just covered that. So Mr. King, yeah, go ahead.
Mr. King, by way of explanation, said that by organizing the committee meant proportioning the officers and men by arming, specifying the kind, size, and caliber of arms, and by disciplining, prescribing the manual exercise, evolution, etc.
So Mr. Sherman withdrew his motion. Mr. Gary stated, the power in the U.S., as explained, is making the states drill sergeants. He had as lief let the citizens of Massachusetts be disarmed as to take the command from the states and subject them to the general legislature. It would be regarded as a system of despotism. This is going down the path of trying to create a permanent army and or a standing army, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so go ahead.
Mr. Madison observed that arming, as explained, did not extend to furnishing arms, nor the term disciplining, to penalties and courts martial for enforcing them.
Okay. And then Mr. King then pipes in again.
Mr. King added to his former explanation that arming meant not only to provide for uniformity of arms, but included authority to regulate the modes of furnishing, either by the militia themselves, the state governments, or the national treasury, that laws for disciplining must involve penalties and everything necessary for enforcing penalties.
Uh-huh. Okay. So these, you know, they, having just fought a revolution, I think they kind of understood some of the pitfalls of not covering some of these things. Because bottom line, Washington barely won that revolution because they weren't getting the requisitions that they were needing. They weren't getting the food. They weren't getting their clothing. There was many things that they weren't getting. So Mr. Dayton then basically moved, and I think this is where they actually kind of commit to it. So let's go ahead and read this.
Mr. Dayton moved to postpone the paragraph in order to take up the following position: to establish a uniform and general system of discipline for the militia of these states, and to make laws for organizing, arming, disciplining, and governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the U.S., reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and all authority over the militia not herein given to the general government.
Okay, so on the question to postpone, it passed in the negative. In other words, there were enough states that said, no, 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 we're not going to accept that. So they kept on moving forward. And as they started talking about the details of this, this is really important. So I'm going to go ahead. The reason this is important, folks, is because our militia and the constitutional framework created a big symbiotic relationship between the states and the federal government. I've said this before, and you've heard me say this, right, Tammy, that the draft, the federal draft, is unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
There's never been anything that granted the federal government to directly, I mean, basically they have to call forth the militia. And the Dick Act basically bypassed all of that. The only way the Dick Act could be legitimate is by amending the Constitution.
Right.
So, this is why we need to kind of go through this, because there are some explanations as to why they were making these fine changes, as we talked already about standing armies. Let's go ahead with Mr. Ellsworth and Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Ellsworth and Sherman moved to postpone the second clause in favor of the following: to establish an uniformity of arms, exercise an organization for the militia, and to provide for the government of them when called into service of the United States. The object of this proposition was to refer the plan for the militia to the general government, but leave the execution of it to the state governments.
Okay, so do you see why the calling forth of the militia, the execution, had to come from the state? So as they start to explain what, why, and how they did it this way and that way, the fact that the federal government just said, well, we already call them up, so we're just going to set up a draft, and we'll be dealing directly with the people. In so doing, they left the states actually, sadly, unprepared to be able to defend itself, and actually took away from the sheriff the ability to have funding for a militia and or posses. Because I talked about this before. I have so many different conversations that sometimes it doesn't make it to the show. But we have talked about posses before. And the whole point of a posse is having a ready reserve. Okay, you got these guns, you know, all you guys have these guns and you got horses. So when I need help, I will, you know, because they had a posse for every town, right? The sheriff was a large area. They had these different communities. Mm-hmm. And they didn't do this that often because for the most part, the people were good, law-abiding citizens. It was a utopian dream. They were creating a system of how they needed to behave, but they were too good and didn't need to behave that way, so they didn't. It was never called for. I mean, how many times did the militia get called up? The first time the militia got called up was in 1812, with the War of 1812. How much work was being done? Now, with Washington, had the British attacked America while he was still president, then, you know, we probably would have been far more ready, because he knew what to do and to keep those things engaged. When it came down to Jefferson and Madison, they were not probably being eyeful, you know, keeping their eye on, you know, maintaining the militia and so forth. They kind of left that over to Congress, and Congress would take care of that stuff, right? That's all in Article 1, not in Article 2. Let's just keep going through this. And so Mr. Gary, I think that's where we're at now.
Mr. Langdon.
Oh, Mr. Langdon. Okay, so let's keep going through this. I thought I said that before, but I guess you didn't read it. So, yeah, let's keep going through this, because I think this really helps breaking these things down. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Langdon said he could not understand the jealousy expressed by some gentlemen. The general and state governments were not enemies to each other, but different institutions for the good of the people of America. As one of the people, he could say, the national government is mine, state government is mine. In transferring power from one to the other, I only take out of my left hand what it cannot so well use and put it into my right hand where it can be better used.
Okay, Mr. Gary, then. Now we're ready for Gary, right?
Yep. Mr. Okay. Gary thought it was rather taking out of the right hand and putting it into the left. Will any man say that the liberty will be as safe in the hands of 80 or 100 men taken from the whole continent as in the hands of 200 or 300 taken from a single state?
So Mr. Dayton then pipes in. Now, you got to remember, when they making some of these references, let's see if they ever talk about actually deploying forces outside of the continent. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Dayton was against so absolute a uniformity. In some states, there ought to be a greater proportion of cavalry than in others. In some places, rifles would be more proper. In others, muskets, etc.
Okay, General Pinckney.
Referred the clause reported by the committee, extending the meaning of it to the case of fines, etc.
Okay. All right. Now, Mr. Madison talks about the county and militia in his comment. Go ahead.
The primary object is to secure an effectual discipline of the militia. This will no more be done if left to the states separately than the requisitions have been hitherto paid by them. The states neglect their militia now, and the more they consolidated into one nation, the less each will rely on its own interior provisions for its safety, and the less prepare its militia for that purpose. In like manner, as the militia of the state would have been still more neglected than it has been if each county had been independently charged with the care of its militia. The discipline of the militia is evidently a national concern and ought to be provided for in the national constitution.
Okay, so it's obvious that the militia needed to be maintained, that the state was, as Madison said, the state was not going to do this. So you would think that had they created an education system of creating standards and everybody had responsibilities, and I think it was General Pinckney that came up and said, you break the whole populace into four or five classes, that you get one class all kind of ready and trained, then you get the next class all kind of ready and trained, then you get the next class, and so eventually you'll have everybody trained and rotating in and out of some basic service. At this point in time, the government, the federal government, and even the state government did not have lots of laws of enforcement. I mean, there were some laws, but these people were being idle. The idea of becoming a professional policeman, really, that was down the road. That was down the road a ways, because I think I mentioned this before, and I say it every Christmas. The first police department that was created in America under the Constitution was in New York, and that was in 1828 or 29. So it was almost 50 years after the Declaration, over 50 years after the Declaration, and pretty close to moving towards 50 years from the Constitution itself, a decade shy. But anyway, let's keep going.
Mr. Martin was confident that the states would never give up the power over the militia, and that if they were to do so, the militia would be less attended to by the general than by the state governments.
Okay, so now Governor Randolph, go ahead.
Mr. Randolph asked what dangers there could be that the militia could be brought into the field and made to commit suicide on themselves. This is a power that cannot, from its nature, be abused unless indeed the whole mass should be corrupted. He was for trammeling the general government wherever there was danger, but here there could be none. He urged this as an essential point, observing that the militia were everywhere neglected by the state legislatures, the member of which hoarded popularity too much to enforce a proper discipline. Leaving the appointment of officers to the states protects the people against every apprehension that could produce murmur.
Okay, so now on question of Mr. Ellsworth's motion, and you got to go kind of back up. Where was Ellsworth's motion? Mr. Sherman and Ellsworth's motion, they were in favor of this clause to establish a uniformity of arms, exercise, and organizations for the militia, and to provide for the government when called into service of the United States, blah, blah, blah. So, okay, so no, no, yes, no, 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 no. So there's only one yes, and that was Connecticut. Why was that? Because Ellsworth and Sherman were from Connecticut. I'm surprised that they didn't vote no on themselves. And so anyway, so the motion didn't pass. And then they said on the question to agree to the first part of the clause, namely to make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Yes, yes, no. Connecticut, of course, no. And then yes, yes, yes. Maryland said no. And then Virginia and everybody else said that. So two no's and the rest were yeses. Okay, so then Madison moved to amend the next part of the clause so as to read, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers under the rank of general officers, right? Well, actually, I believe that they left in the Constitution, all officers were left to be appointed by the states, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's keep going, though. Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Sherman considered this as absolutely inadmissible. He said that if the people should be so far asleep as to allow the most influential officers of the militia to be appointed by the general government, every man of discernment would rouse them by sounding the alarm to them.
Okay. So, as we... Let me see here, because I just pulled it up. Article 1, Section 8, when we look at the call for the militia and to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers. It does not say general. So, there you go. You were right. And so... let's go ahead with the next one. Mr. Gary, I think. Yeah.
Mr. Gary, let us at once destroy the state governments, have an executive for life or hereditary, and a proper Senate, and then there would be some consistency in giving full powers to the general government. But as the states are not to be abolished, he wondered at the attempts that were made to give powers inconsistent with their existence.
Okay, we've got a break here. So with that, we'll kind of reread Gary, because, again, we were kind of focused. This is where they really talk about how to form the military and what powers were really given and why. This is actually what helps really expose the fact of, you know, the limitations placed on, you know, the actual militia and the homeland defense. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I find it interesting that Gary from Massachusetts comes right out and says, let us once destroy the state governments, have an executive for life or hereditary, and a proper Senate, and then there would become the inconsistency in giving full powers to the general government. So I don't know if he's just using hyperbole, but he was basically trying to be a little dramatic, because at the very end he says, others of a more dramatic cast will oppose it with equal determination, and a civil war may be produced by the conflict. I don't think, well, we realize that there was no real civil war that was created because of the governing and how they devised this federal government. The civil war came from the clash in paradigms regarding labor, where there were those who thought that slavery was appropriate form of labor, where everybody else said, no, it's repugnant, it's wrong, it's immoral, and we got to end it. Right? Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. Caught yourself, didn't you? Yeah, you're getting good at that. Anyway, so Madison pipes in and says what?
Mr. Madison, as the greatest danger is that of disunion of the states, it is necessary to guard against it by sufficient powers to the common government. And as the greatest danger to liberty is from large standing armies, it is best to prevent them by an effectual provision for good militia.
There you go. So there is the first reference that the greatest danger to liberty is from large standing armies. You know what? It's red, but I think that really needs to be a much larger font. So guess what? I'm going to do that. And I'm going to increase the size of that font and make it bold so that everybody understands that this point was being brought up, why standing armies were considered dangerous. What do you consider the ATF to be? What do you consider the BLM to be? These are standing armies. And when you look, it's not the military and the military structure, because the military structure was so confined. And more importantly, also confined with this concept of enforcement, the militia was the only entity empowered to execute the laws. So where did they get off creating the FBI, the ATF, and all of these other enforcement entities? Well, because we didn't know that they couldn't. They told us that they could. And they said, don't worry, we understand what's going on here. And they did. But it wasn't the right thing that they were doing. Okay, so Mr. Madison then basically says, on the question to agree with Mr. Madison's motion, yes, no, 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 yes, yes. So interestingly enough, not even Virginia carried Madison's motion, but New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Georgia did. Okay, so on the question to agree to the, quote, reserving to the states the appointment of the officers, it was agreed without any contentions. On the question on the clause and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by the U.S., yes, 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 and one no, two no's, three, four no's. So on the question agreed for Article 7, Section 7, as reported, it basically passed without any contention. So I don't know. It didn't say whether this passed or not, but because you had four no's. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 with four. Yeah, I guess it did pass. Okay. All right, Mr. Pinckney, go ahead.
Mr. Pinckney urged the necessity of preserving foreign ministers and other officers of the U.S. independent of external influence and moved to insert, after Article 7, Section 7, the clause following, no person holding any office of profit or trust under the U.S. shall, without the consent of the legislature, except of any present emolument, officer title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state which passed.
Okay, without any contention. Mr. Rutledge then moved to amend Article 8. So this is interesting. If you didn't understand what they're talking about, Article 7, Article 8, they're still using the framework of the Articles of Confederation.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they end up doing is they just move everything around. And it's kind of difficult to do back in those days, unless you actually printed out each of the little sections so you could move them around like a collage. And, well, let's put this in front, to where that's kind of how they laid it out. Everything based on the legislature, everything concerning the legislature, that was Article 1. Everything concerning the president, Article 2, so forth and so on. So I believe with what we're covering here is just a lot of the little details and passing and framing of the Constitution. So what we want to do is we want to jump down a little bit further and actually hit August 29th with property and slaves, because they bring it up again. They still haven't settled this. So with Mr. Governor Morris, you're probably scrolling down and scrolling down.
Yeah.
Oh.
August 29th.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris opposed the object of the motion as highly injurious. Preferences to American ships will multiply them till they can carry the southern produce cheaper than it is now carried. A navy was essential to security, particularly of the southern states, and can only be had by a navigation act encouraging American bottoms and seamen. In those points of view, then alone, it is the interest of the southern states that navigation acts should be facilitated. Shipping, he said, was the worst and most precarious kind of property and stood in need of public patronage.
Patronage, you got it.
Patronage.
So okay. Patronage means you're a consumer. Patronage means you're putting them down.
Ah.
You know, don't patronize me, mm-hmm. right? Well, anyway. Mr. Williamson basically went down the path of he was in favor of making two-thirds of, instead of a majority requisite for a satisfactory, or I should say, for it, I think they're talking about possibly an amendment to the Southern people. No useful measure, he believed, had been lost in Congress for want of 9 votes. As to the weakness of the Southern states, he was not alarmed on that account. The sickliness, and actually, Mr. Williamson, by the way, is of Pennsylvania, the sickliness of their climate, and I think with the, you're looking at that as sick, right? I think that they mm-hmm. meant to be like cycle.
Mm, okay. Oh, gotcha.
The sickliness of their climate for invaders would prevent their being made an object. He acknowledged that he did not think the motion required two-thirds necessary in itself, because if a majority of northern states would push their regulations too far, the southern states would build ships for themselves. but he knew the Southern people were apprehensive on this subject and would be pleased with the precaution. Now, Mr. Spade of North Carolina, go ahead.
It was against the motion. The Southern states could at any time save themselves from oppression by building ships for their own use.
So here's the question. Along the Southern states, what is the largest port that you can think of? Can't think of one, can you?
I don't know.
When you look at the Eastern Seaboard, you know, back in those days, you know, a port was easily accessible and easily made because the ships didn't require, because their draw, or they didn't have really deep hulls, so they could go up rivers, the Potomac. But today, what port in America, what are the two major ports on the eastern side of America?
I don't actually know.
So Louisiana and New York, Boston right. being then third, and there are some other ports that, you know, are used, like Norfolk and so forth. But for the most part, they're not really big contenders. And one of the reasons why is because the goods from Europe got too expensive. Everything shifted to the west, to the Pacific, because more and more goods were coming from the Asian community, or the Asian part of the planet, right? So now you can see from San Diego all the way up to Seattle are major ports that bring in, I mean, the only reason why New York is just because of its immensity. But when you look at how much more shipping comes into Los Angeles over New York, it's just amazing. But that's because L.A. has several ports all in it, if you really look. Seal Beach and so forth and so on. Long Beach, there's all sorts of ports along the L.A. Basin. Now, Seattle has a pretty major port, but it only brings in stuff for the, really, for the Pacific Northwest area and along the northern corridor, right? All the way out to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I think if you actually looked at throughputs and so forth, you'd find that there's far more commerce being shipped into the western ports. And there's probably a lot of commerce being shipped out of the eastern ports of where we're shipping stuff to Europe. But I believe with the tariffs, I believe with the plan that what Trump wants to do is that we stop importing so much and start exporting more and producing more. Because when you're producing more, you're actually growing as a nation. When you're buying more, you're not growing. You're actually helping others grow. It's good to have a healthy trade, but we don't even have that. So anyway, let's go ahead and jump down. I think you're on, what, Mr. Butler?
Mr. Butler.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Butler differed from those who consider the rejection of the motion as no concession on the part of the southern states. He considered the interest of these and of the eastern states to be as different as the interests of Russia and Turkey, being notwithstanding desirous of conciliating the affections of the east states, he should vote against requiring 2/3 instead of a majority.
Okay. So that's kind of interesting that they're only talking about legislative votes, by the way. In other words, they were talking about what would it take for a bill to pass. I don't see anything talking about making amendments, and these aren't dealing with necessarily amendments to the Constitution. Because as the outcome really came, the amendments were required by the states, not Congress. So I think what we're looking at is the fact that they were just looking at the majority. So Colonel Mason basically pipes in and says this. Go ahead.
If the government is to be lasting, it must be founded in the confidence and affections of the people and must be so constructed as to obtain these. The majority will be governed by their interests. The southern states are the minority in both houses. It is to be expected that they will deliver themselves bound hand and foot to the eastern states and enable them to exclaim in the words of Cromwell on a certain association, "The Lord hath delivered them into our hands."
And I think that that probably raised a couple of eyebrows in those southern state delegates. Mr. Wilson, go ahead.
Mr. Wilson took notice of the several objections and remarked that if every peculiar interest was to be secured, unanimity ought to be required. The majority, he said, would be no more governed by the interest than the minority. It was surely better to let the latter be bound hand and foot than the former. Great inconveniences had, he contended, been experienced in Congress from the Article of Confederation requiring 9 votes in certain cases.
Now, I've always loved Madison's contributions, and of course, they're far more verbose, more content, more words, because he's just leaving a little note. And I'm thinking he's filling in the blanks at the end of the day when he goes back and kind of finishes his entries. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Madison, go ahead.
Mr. Madison went into a pretty full view of the subject. He observed that the disadvantage to the southern states from a navigation act lay chiefly in a temporary rise of freight, attended, however, with an increase of southern as well as northern shipping, with the immigration of northern seamen and merchants to the southern states, and with removal of the existing and injurious retaliations among the states on each other. The power of foreign nations to obstruct our retaliating measures on them by a corrupt influence would also be less if a majority should be made competent than if 2/3 of each house should be required to legislative acts in this case.
Okay. So right there, what you basically are hearing is that they're already talking about, or at least Madison's pointing out the obvious, that they're currently, with the current system, they've got retaliations amongst each other. I mean, it's like they're not much of a union under the Articles of Confederation. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay,
yeah.
So and looking at this even further, you know, he's basically saying that what we need to do is we need to make sure it's just a majority. And that's what he says here. Relating measures on them by a corrupt influence would also be less if a majority should be made competent than if 2/3. Because what do you got to do to get these other people to go along? You got to buy their votes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So go ahead from that point on.
An abuse of the power would be qualified with all these good effects, but he thought an abuse was rendered improbable by the provision of 2 branches, by the independence of the Senate, by the negative of the executive, by the interests of Connecticut and New Jersey, which were agricultural, not commercial, states, by the interior interests, which was also agricultural in the most commercial states, by the accession of western states, which would be altogether agricultural. He added that the southern states would derive an essential advantage in the general security afforded by the increase of our maritime strength. He stated the vulnerable situation of them all, and of Virginia in particular. The increase of the coasting trade and of seamen would also be favorable to the southern states by increasing the consumption of their produce. If the wealth of the eastern should in a still greater proportion be augmented, that wealth would contribute to the more of public wants and be otherwise a national benefit.
Okay. So he's recognizing something I've mentioned before, where Jefferson and Hamilton ended up squaring off on whether America should, you know, hold tight to agrarian modes of commerce instead of mercantile and manufacturing. And so Madison is actually pointing out that going towards the mercantile and manufacturing is where there'd be a greater national benefit. Now, Mr. Rutledge, and I think he's a southern state man. I think he's North Carolina, maybe South Carolina. These are the Carolinas. Go ahead.
Mr. Rutledge was against the motion of his colleague. It did not follow from a grant of the power to regulate trade that it would be abused. At the worst, a Navigation Act could bear hard a little while only on the southern states. As we are laying the foundation for the great empire, we ought to take permanent view of the subject and not look at the present moment only. He reminded the House of the necessity of securing the West India trade to this country. That was the great object. A Navigation Act was necessary for obtaining it.
Okay, Mr. Randolph of Virginia, go ahead.
Mr. Randolph said that there were features so odious in the Constitution as it now stands that he doubted whether he should be able to agree to it. The rejection of the motion would complete the deformity of the system. He took notice of the argument in favor of giving the power over trade to a majority drawn from the opportunity foreign powers would have of obstructing retaliating measures if two-thirds were made requisite. He did not think there was weight in that consideration. The difference between a majority and two-thirds did not afford room for such an opportunity. Foreign influence would also be more likely to be exerted on the president, who could require three-fourths by his negative. He did not mean, however, to enter into the merits. What he had in view was merely to pave the way for a declaration which he might be hereafter obliged to make if an accumulation of obnoxious ingredients should take place that he could not give his assent to the plan.
Okay, so right here he basically is pointing out that it would require two-thirds of both houses, and then to overcome a presidential veto, it would require three-fourths, something that's not in the Constitution. See, it only takes a two-thirds majority to overturn a veto because it's only a majority to get things done. So when you think about the concept of republic review, and how the declarations, or I should say directives, come from the states to tell Congress, you need to get rid of this. If we have a majority control, everything we ask for will be accomplished because it only requires a majority, and so it be, and it will be, I should say. Okay, so Mr. Gorham, right here, go ahead.
Mr. Gorham, if the government is to be so fettered as to be unable to relieve the eastern states, what motive can they have to join in it and thereby tie their own hands for measures which they could otherwise take for themselves? The eastern states were not led to strengthen the Union by fear for their own safety. He deprecated the consequences of disunion, but if it should take place, it was a southern part of the continent that had the most reason to dread them. He urged the improbability of a combination against the interest of the southern states, the different situations of the northern and middle states being as security against it. It was moreover certain that foreign ships would never be altogether excluded, especially those of nations in treaty with us.
Okay, so just to be clear, folks, it was deprecated, not defecated. When you said it so quickly and you said it right, I just wanted to make sure that people understood that it was deprecated.
Deprecated.
Right, which sounds a lot like defecated. Okay. Okay, so anyway, we now come into the admissions of states. How was it so? And so let's just kind of scroll down to the red. And we're now talking about how states are going to be admitted. Remember, at this point in time, the concept of equal footing was only an idea trying to get legs because the prevailing thought was that the new states that joined the Union would come in with a disadvantage. That was the majority in the delegation. Or I should say, at the convention, the majority was still planning on doing that. So now we're going to talk about where are they now, because we're really towards the end of August. We're just a couple of weeks away from signing the Constitution. It came in this late. Okay, so Mr.
Wow.
Governor Morris, go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to strike out the two last sentences, to wit, if the admission be consented to, the new states shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states. The legislature may make conditions with the new states concerning the public debt, which shall be then subsisting. He did not wish to bind down the legislature to admit Western states on the terms here stated.
Ah, so in other words, they didn't want to inflict any types of financial burdens upon the states coming in.
Mr. Madison opposed the motion, insisting that the Western states neither would nor ought to submit to a union which degraded them from an equal rank with other states.
Okay, so the bolstering up of equal footing. Mr. Mason.
If it were possible by just means to prevent emigrations to the Western country, it might be good policy, but go the people will as they find it for their interest, and the best policy is to treat them with that equality which will make them friends, not enemies.
There we go. Mr. Morris. Back to Mr. Morris. Go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris did not mean to discourage the growth of the Western country. He knew that to be impossible. He did not wish, however, to throw the power into their hands.
Ah, Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Sherman was against the motion and for fixing an equality of privileges by the Constitution.
Okay, so in other words, leave it up to the legislature, because that's kind of where we left it last, that the legislature would be able to play shenanigans. Okay, so Mr. Langdon.
Mr. Langdon was in favor of the motion. He did not know what circumstances might arise which would render it inconvenient to admit new states on terms of equality.
Okay, Mr. Williamson.
Mr. Williamson was for leaving the legislature free. The existing small states enjoy inequality now, and for that reason are admitted to it in the Senate. This reason is not applicable to new Western states.
Okay, and so on Mr. Governor Morris's motion for striking it out, was it carried? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 yeses, and only 2 noes. So it was carried. And so now Mr. Martin, and what was he motioning? He was striking out, if the admission be consented to, that he's basically wanting to take that away. Okay, so now Mr. Martin and Governor Morris moved to strike out Article, what is that, 17? But to such admission, the consent of 2/3 of the members present shall be necessary, close quote, before any question was taken on this motion. And Mr. Governor Morris moved that the following proposition was a substitute for that, and he basically states this, quote, new states may be admitted by the legislature into this union, but no new states shall be erected within the limits of any of the present states without the consent of the legislature as of such state, as well as the general legislature. Now, we're really running out of time here, so let's just leave it right there, and then we'll pick this back up tomorrow. Okay? So, folks, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of how they're going to finally lay out the admission of states. This is so important because as they started admitting states of the Union, they abandoned the Constitution, and the federal government started levying and basically waging warfare upon the states joining into the Union. And all of it was unconstitutional. With that, I'm Jerry Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.